the Black History Podcast. Thank you for joining us this week. As always, I'm your host, Nishad Carrington. We're back this week and we're keeping in the United States and namely in the Northeast. And I'm sure if you're like me, then you've heard the story ad nauseum about the Pilgrims and the Mayflower, the ship that brought them to Plymouth Rock in late fall of 1620. The governor of the Plymouth colony the following year proclaimed a day of, quote, Thanksgiving to celebrate the first harvest in America, thus the time-honored American tradition of Thanksgiving continually being celebrated even to today. The true story of Thanksgiving we will not get into, but I wholeheartedly encourage you to do your own independent research on that and actually learn why the holiday isn't so great in the grand scheme of things. I know when my daughter's old enough to understand and process, when she comes home telling me that she learned about Thanksgiving, likely in school while drawing a hand turkey or something, we'll have to have a heart-to-heart sit down and I'll give her the real story that her schools won't tell her. But Jamestown Colony was established as the first permanent English colony in North America in 1607. But I'll bet what you didn't know was that prior to the Pilgrims arriving in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620, Black folks were already in Jamestown prior to 1619. Now, although there were Black people living in Jamestown prior to 1619, it was actually the arrival of approximately 20 Africans in 1619 that officially marks the beginning of slavery in the United States of America. In April 1619, Sir George Yeardley, the then governor of the Jamestown colony, sent an English ship on what was supposed to be a routine trading voyage. The ship was called the Treasurer, but the Treasurer was not alone. Along for the journey was a Dutch man of war ship. And a man of war is what we would typically picture as being this old-time naval battleship, meaning it has cannons armed along the side and sails being propelled by sails rather than oars. Sir Yeardley classified the trip as routine trading, but what the true intention of the trip was a mercenary mission to raid Spanish shipping routes, with the Dutch ship providing the necessary muscle and cover for the activities. Both of the ships sent, the Treasurer and the Dutch man of war, were owned by the same man, an Englishman named Robert Rich, the then Earl of Warwick. So I'm sure you are well aware of the motto of the show, especially if you subscribe in iTunes or Google Play, that being, our history doesn't begin at slavery. So I can also imagine you are wondering why we are discussing the Plymouth colony and slaves being brought there. Well, for good measure, it's background for the true story we're discussing today, and it'll help to provide a little bit of color for the time in which we're discussing. Now, historians have said for the first time in August of 1981 that there's enough evidence to suggest that one of the early settlers of the Plymouth colony in New England was, in fact, a Black man. For years prior to 1981, researchers and historians believed that there was, in fact, a Black pilgrim. But it wasn't until 1981 that they were able to confirm with any certainty. By searching through Plymouth Colony records, researchers were made to believe that a man named Abraham Pierce settled in Plymouth in 1623, 3 years after the very first European colonist arrived on the Mayflower. Pierce is listed in the Plymouth Colony, and all records indicate that he owned land, voted, and had equal standing with others in the community as well. When Plymouth Colony was incorporated in 1633, Pierce was listed in records as a freeholder and voting member of the community. But there's only one reference to Pierce's race in the colony records. It's a colony record dated from 1643, where there's a listing for men available to serve in the Plymouth militia, where there's an insert that says, quote, Abraham Pierce, Blackamoor. In that time, Blackamoor was a term for a Black person. There is no date for when Pierce was born, but it's believed that he was born in the West Indies and eventually brought to Jamestown, Virginia in 1619 as an enslaved person. But there's a little bit of a discrepancy in the historical record, because other records indicate that Pierce came to Plymouth as an indentured servant from England on board a ship named Anne in 1623. Now, the question I'd have is a simple one, to put some thought and hopefully clarity to the issue, which seems to be more probable to me, and hopefully it does to you as well. Which seems to be more probable? an enslaved person becoming a landowner and voter, or an indentured servant becoming a landowner and having equal voting rights as any other citizen in the colony. I tend to believe that it's the indentured servant route. But here's the thing. When a historian found the original document from 1643, there was a slight difference. On one line was the name Abraham Pierce, and under his name, not next to it, were the words the Blackamoor. One interpretation would provide that this would mean that there were two men, Abraham Pierce and another unidentified black man. But apparently, Abraham Pierce appears in the colonial record more than 30 times. It's known that he marries someone who is a part of the regular community. He has children and they continue on to produce a line of descendants. In fact, a 19th century well-known abolitionist named Charles Sumner references Abraham Pierce as being a black pilgrim. There appears to be another black man who lived in Plymouth from 1623 and 1624 named either John or Juan Pedro. Except for the possibility that in a census he is the individual referred to as Negro John, the only description of him as a black can be found in a list of arrivals to the area which reads, John Pedro arrived on the Swan age 30. Because historians unanimously agree that since the Swan had sailed from New England, Pedro had first lived in Plymouth, having arrived with the Weston Expedition in 1622, a year earlier than Pierce. So even if Abraham Pierce is, for the time being, unacceptable as a black pilgrim, the figure of John Pedro is certainly eligible for such an important national icon. Now, as I mentioned before, the story of Abraham Pierce came out in 1981, but this wasn't met without outcry and controversy. When authorities first began breathing down the necks of federally funded institutions over the matter of minority inclusion a few months earlier, executives at the Plymouth Living History Museum were relieved that they had Abraham Pierce to showcase. Despite, or indeed because of the enthusiastic reception he got in the press, the introduction of an African-American Abraham Pierce to the museum did not go over too well with certain portions of the local population, especially those whose pretensions were expressed by membership in institutions like the Mayflower Society. Not only did this element succeed in getting rid of the black actor who had been hired to interpret the role of Abraham Pierce, it was also responsible for forcing the museum to fire the curator who would not back down on the century-old historical reading that this particular pilgrim was racially of African extraction. Now, according to records, Abraham Pierce died in 1673. We talked about John or Juan Pedro, but what about the others? Now, we know that black pilgrims served in the Plymouth Militia in the 1640s. These pilgrims of black heritage would have been given military training, including best usage of their weapons and marching in formation. The integrated Plymouth Pilgrim Militia included English, African Americans, and Native Americans. As the record indicates, though slaves existed, some pilgrims in 17th century Plymouth accepted the concept that blacks had God-given rights. One of these was their right to attend Pilgrim Congregational Church. People of black heritage had the right to learn the Pilgrim Bible, and pilgrims taught their children to read in order to understand the teachings in the Bible. This was an accepted method of education for all colonists. I said some pilgrims because the question presents, if the pilgrims believed that blacks had God-given rights, why then were they and Native Americans placed in the back of the church? Now, to understand this dynamic, it may be first necessary to get a bit of understanding as to how English society was structured. Now, remember, England is where the pilgrims first came from. Well, English society was structured based on one's status at birth. Englishmen born into English royalty were given the highest social status, followed by wealthy Englishmen, the growing merchant middle class, and finally by peasants or commoners. Native Americans were labeled as savages by the English, while blacks were forced into slavery in the English Caribbean colonies. Pilgrims carried English structured society viewpoints with them, yet they differed from English society on how they viewed persons of black heritage. Pilgrims gave blacks weapons to use in the Plymouth Militia and access to their congregational religion. Blacks were not simply viewed as property. Black people were viewed as having souls. and they could be trusted with weapons and trained for the defense of the Plymouth colony. Blacks were integrated in an essential part of the Plymouth colony militia. English pilgrim men were placed on one side of the church pews, and English women and children on the other. English pilgrim men were accepted as being of higher order in society than were the women. Indians, Native Americans, and blacks were expected to sit in the back of the church. This seating arrangement was done, effectively, to reinforce the concept that everyone knew his place in pilgrim society. While pilgrims in Plymouth held the belief that both Indians and people of black heritage had souls, they were not willing to accept these two groups as their social equals. Yet, they had an obligation to God to bring the congregational Protestant religion to them. So, between 1623 and 1692, black people in Plymouth Colony fell predominantly into three groups. They were freemen, bonded or indentured servants, or slaves. Black people who had attained freeman status, however, did not have the same rights as white freemen. White English freeman status enabled the Plymouth colonists to vote and to own land. If blacks with freeman status ever had these rights, it would have been very rare. Freeman status blacks were considered people, not just property. They could not be bought or sold, and families would not be split up. Freemen had the right to move freely around the Plymouth colony without needing a master's permission. Some freeman status blacks did become bonded or indentured by incurring debt, and the common necessities of life needed to survive the harsh New England climate may have forced some black and white colonists to give up their freeman status. Now, that's not to say that slavery didn't occur in the Plymouth colony. Obviously, earlier I told you that slave ships arrived in 1619, but slavery wasn't as prevalent in New England as it was later in the South. Namely, that's because the white pilgrim colonists could barely feed themselves and maintain their own families, let alone provide for and maintain slaves. Now, if you remember, last week we talked about Crispus Attucks and the start of the American Revolutionary War. Now, this week, as I suggested, we're going to stay in the New England area, as you can tell, but we're going to actually keep in the same respect of Crispus Attucks and the American Revolutionary War to a degree. So if you haven't heard the Crispus Attucks episode, I'd encourage you to take a listen to it, but it's not necessary to cut this one off. There's enough distinction between the two that you won't miss anything. So, slight spoiler alert, if you haven't listened to the Crispus Attucks episode, as we discussed, Crispus Attucks was a runaway slave, but he lived in Boston as a freeman. So what about the others? In 1708, there were over 1,000 slaves in Massachusetts, a number that rose steadily for decades and established Boston as a center of the American slave trade. Now, by 1750, there were over 13,000 slaves in Massachusetts. Boston slave merchants established a trade as far off as Madagascar, off of Africa's southeast coast, trading Caribbean rum for slaves who were victims of intertribal warfare. In fact, most African Americans in colonial Massachusetts were slaves. However, there was a small but growing population of blacks who were not. Many of these freemen were either slaves that had purchased their own freedom, were given freedom by their masters, or were descendants of slaves that had done one or the other. Like other ethnic groups, free black people tended to band together in their own communities, such as Boston's Beacon Hill, one of the earliest examples of such a neighborhood. It was called the Back of the Hill in colonial times and was considered an undesirable place to live by most whites. Free African colonists worked hard to try to provide a future for their children, but it was really nearly impossible, as opportunities for blacks to move up in society were very few and very far between. While working to improve their own lives and those of their families in a society still dominated by the culture and economy created by slavery, free Africans also worked towards a day when one person could never own another. Paul Cuffey, man who we'll probably do an episode about at some point, was an African-American shipbuilder from Dartmouth and a freeman. And he actually petitioned the Massachusetts legislature in 1780. And Cuffey said that African-Americans should not have to pay taxes. I think we all like that, especially with this being tax season, since they had, quote, no voice of influence in the election of those who tax us, end quote. Now, as slavery grew and the slave trade thrived, though there were not a ton of slaves in the northern part of the country, at least nowhere near as many as there were in the southern states, much of the Northeast money came from the slave trade. And the number of Africans in New England grew from fewer than 1,000 in 1700 to some 16,000 by the end of the 18th century. The majority spent at least part of their lives enslaved, often bought as children by owners in coastal cities. They accounted for as much as 30% of the population in South Kingston, Rhode Island, and were a very significant presence in Boston, being about 10%, New London being about 9%, and New York as well being about 7.5%. In fact, just before the Revolutionary War broke out, New York was the second largest urban center of slavery after Charleston, North Carolina. Owned mostly by ministers, doctors, and the merchant elite, enslaved men and women in the North often performed household duties in addition to skilled jobs. But as we discussed last week with Crispus Attucks, by the time the Revolutionary War came about, enslaved Africans, freemen, and the like played a very large part of New England and colonial society. Now let's run this back for a real quick second. From the time of the arrival of the first enslaved Africans to the American colonies in 1619, the enslaved persons were generally welcomed into the ranks of the local militia to help counter the threat from local Native American tribes. And in fact, this practice continued, especially in the northern colonies, for more than 150 years until George Washington, who you may have just heard of, took control of the Continental Army in 1775. George Washington and his compadres saw no use for the enlistment of blacks, either enslaved or free. This was probably for a number of reasons, and honestly, there's a bit of irony involved with enslaved persons being used to fight for freedom that isn't their own. Some of the slave owners didn't want to risk their, quote, property being used in combat, or perhaps have their enslaved persons freed for use in service. But more pressing to the reality of the society, especially in the South, where blacks outnumbered whites, whites feared the potential consequences of arming black people. But Massachusetts took the first action to ban enlistment, passing a resolution that read, quote, "No slaves be permitted into this army upon any consideration whatsoever," end quote. Now, George Washington actually took it a little bit further on July 10th, 1775 to order, quote, "You are not to enlist any stroller, Negro, or vagabond," end quote. George Washington and other officials did not want blacks in their ranks and did not see the revolution as a vehicle to end slavery, even though they were seeking independence for themselves. While the Declaration of Independence began with "all men are created equal," there is no evidence that its author Thomas Jefferson or any of his signers had any intention of ending slavery in America. Thomas Jefferson himself, being a slave owner, did include a clause condemning the British King George III for interfering with colonial law prohibiting the future importation of slaves, but even that was deleted in the final draft after opposition from representatives from Georgia and South Carolina. Now, while George Washington made efforts to keep blacks out of his ranks, the British were not reluctant to have them. Seeking to exploit American prejudices and to bolster their own ranks that were operating far from home, many British commanders welcomed escaped slaves into their camps. And on November 7, 1775, John Murray, the Earl of Dunmore and the royal governor of the colony of Virginia, issued a proclamation that read, quote, "I do hereby declare all indentured servants, Negroes, or others free that are able and willing to bear arms, they joining His Majesty's troops, as soon as you may be, for the more speedily reducing this colony to proper dignity," end quote. Slaves immediately began to risk the dangers of flight from bondage with a yearning for freedom. Within a month, Lord Dunmore organized more than 300 escaped slaves into what he called his Ethiopian Regiment, complete with uniforms emblazed with the slogan, "Liberty to Slaves." Over the next 5 months, more than 30,000 former slaves rallied to Dunmore's promise of freedom. Some, like the Ethiopian Regiment, took up places in the front lines, while others worked in the rear as wagon masters, cooks, and laborers. Others assumed more unusual jobs. Bill Richmond, described as a man of color, served as the hangman when the rebel spy Nathan Hale was executed in New York City in 1776. Now, knowing that many slaves were actually joining the British and facing personal shortages of his own, George Washington reconsidered his policy of exclusion. On December 30, 1775, he issued orders allowing the enlistment of free blacks, but continued his ban on the recruitment of slaves. Washington's subordinates welcomed this policy, and many went so far as to ignore the second part and enlist black soldiers with no concern of their status of free or slave. Setbacks on the battlefield in 1776 forced the rebels to take even further action. When the members of the Continental Congress asked the states in September to provide an additional 88 battalions to reinforce the army and another 16 battalions 3 months later, they suggested that the states could fill their quotas, quote, by draft from their militias or in any other way, end quote. Field commanders interpreted the any other way portion of that as an authorization to recruit African Americans. The mid-Atlantic and northern states began to accept blacks, slave and free, into integrated ranks. The southern states remained reluctant to arm and serve with black soldiers, but did in fact recruit them for support roles. All blacks were promised freedom for their service, and their owners were promised compensation for the loss of their property. For the remainder of the war, blacks served alongside whites while in pursuit of liberty and independence. In the 1851 painting, Washington Crossing the Delaware, which I'm sure you've probably seen, artist Emmanuel Lutzi shows a black soldier at George Washington's side in their boat as they cross the river to earn a much-needed victory at Trenton, New Jersey on December 26th, 1776. African Americans contributed to the Revolution in the Navy as well. Because of the hazards of the sea, fishing and merchant vessels were always short of crewmen and did not pay any attention to the color of a sailor's skin if he was willing to serve. This actually harkens back to the Crispus Attucks episode when we suggest that many escaped slaves, free and I guess escaped slaves, traveled to Boston to become seamen. Apparently that was a profession or a vocation in which many freemen and escaped slaves were able to thrive and were readily hired. So the newly formed U.S. Navy and state vessels continued this tradition. At no time were blacks barred from service on warships during the Revolution. The U.S. Marine Corps in its infancy also welcomed black recruits, and at least 13 served on U.S. ships. Blacks also served in the ranks of the allies of the American rebels. 600 of the 3,500 French troops who fought to retake Savannah, Georgia in the fall of 1779 were black freemen and slaves recruited in France's Caribbean colonies. The Spanish governor of Louisiana, Bernardo de Galvez, also employed black soldiers in his campaign against the British in the Mississippi Valley along the Gulf Coast. It is impossible to determine the exact count of the number of blacks who served in the American Revolution. Enlistment records, when preserved or kept at all, rarely note a soldier's race. From what information is available, it appears that about 5,000 of the 300,000 men who joined the ranks of the Continental Army and Navy and state militias were African American, or about 1 in 60, or about 2% of the total. This number is not totally revealing because blacks enlisted for the duration of the war, while whites enlisted for shorter periods of time. Since the rebels never had more than 35,000 soldiers in the field at any one time, it is actually likely that at times blacks composed 10% of the ranks of the Continental Army. Blacks who fought on both sides did indeed secure their freedom. Those in the U.S. military were freed, and those who joined Lord Dunmore were evacuated as free men to Nova Scotia, the British West Indies, and the newly established African colony of Sierra Leone. Several northern states abolished human servitude in the post-war years, including Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont. A few other states initiated measures to slowly eliminate slavery, but the majority of the former colonies continued the practice. In fact, the number of black slaves in the United States increased sevenfold, from 500,000 to 3.5 million in the three quarters of a century from the end of the Revolution until emancipation during and after the American Civil War. It would not be again until the Korean War of the 1950s that African Americans were again permitted to serve in integrated units. In the years after the Revolution, blacks received little credit for their participation and support. It was, in fact, not until September 16, 1863, in the midst of the Civil War, that one of the earliest and best summaries of their service appeared in an article entitled Negro Soldiers in the Revolution, and that appeared in the Army and Navy Journal. And it said, quote, "The record is clear that from the beginning to the conclusion of the War of the Revolution, Negroes served in the Continental armies with intelligence, courage, and steadfastness, and that important results in several instances are directly traceable to their good conduct," end quote. Now, Cato Howe is not a name that we will find in our history books. Nothing, in fact, is known of Cato Howe's early life before his military service. Cato fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill, but since he was just one person in a large army, his military exploits were pretty anonymous. But Cato Howe was different than most of his military contemporaries, both in the military and in his hometown of Plymouth, Massachusetts. Cato Howe was black. But Cato Howe wasn't the only black man to serve in the American Revolution, as I'm sure you're well aware of, we've gone through. In fact, four black men were granted land by the town of Plymouth following the war, those men being Cato Howe, Plato Turner, Prince Goodwin, and Kwamene Quash. These men each built homes and left behind a legacy that unfortunately is relatively unknown today. But we do know a bit about Cato Howe. According to historians prior to the war, it's almost a guarantee that he was enslaved, and according to records, at least 573 black men served in the Massachusetts armies and earned their freedom through this service. But just as so many black soldiers that served the United States in war and then returned home, the reception wasn't so great for these men either. When Cato returned to Plymouth after being discharged from the military in 1783, while the state saw to it that these people were free, it did little or nothing to provide for their new needs and subsistence. Employment and housing were difficult to come by. Without doubt, the state knew of these deficiencies, but did very little to rectify their issues. Not much is known about Cato from 1783 until March 12, 1792. On that day, the town of Plymouth voted and granted a strip of land, as they put it, about 20 rods wide and about a mile and a half long on the easterly side of the sheep pasture to such persons as will clear the same in the term of 3 years. Those persons were Cato, Goodwin, Turner, and Quash. The four of them went on to establish a community on that property, it being called Parting Ways or New Guinea. All four of the men lived out their days in the area and in fact are buried there now. Their graves can be seen today with markers of simple field stones. In 1975, an archaeological investigation of the Parting Ways community was started. Renewed interest in the tiny community and its inhabitants had been generated by a special town bicentennial committee on black history, and this group's efforts at first were directed at the cemetery. Its location had not been lost over the years, and as a part of the town's bicentennial program, volunteer groups landscaped the area. At the same time, the committee sought and obtained a vote at Plymouth Town Hall meeting to set the land aside for memorial purposes, including the area of the Parting Ways settlement. It was in this area that archaeological excavations were carried out, and in 1979, the United States Department of the Interiors erected the marker that declares it a National Archaeological District and Revolutionary War Veterans Cemetery. Under the leadership of Parting Ways leaders like Marjorie Anderson, Everett Hoagland, Barboza, and Johnson, the town of Plymouth in 2004 rededicated 29.6 acres of the original 106 acres given to their four veterans. The rest of it had Route 80 and Boston's Archdiocese Sacred Heart School built over top of it. So that's our episode. I promise I will not stick on Boston or New England or the American Revolution too much longer. I don't really know why these two episodes ended up being back to back, but I think they flowed pretty well. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, if you see anything that we did wrong with this episode, please let me know. The research was a little extensive. It's a little tough to find things on African Americans and black soldiers of the American Revolutionary War. You know, quick little snippet at the end with regard to a settlement, Parting Ways. It actually took me back to the one that was in New York that we did an episode on not too long ago. If you don't remember it, hopefully you'll go find it. Took me back to that, just kind of reminded me at the end of the day. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please shoot us an email or visit our website. We love to see the reviews that are left in iTunes. We are new to the Google Play Store now too, so if you have an Android device, you can surely find our podcast there as well. As always, hope you learned something. Hope you enjoyed it. And remember, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and see you next time.